Hello, citizens. This is Deadbug. Friend. Lover. Father. Father of many, actually. And some of them are from those godless third world countries. And I gotta support them all. Well, not the ones from the godless third world countries, because, you know, their cords can't touch me. But nevertheless, the other ones, I gotta divvy up some money sometimes. And you can help me. Sign up to my Patreon, where you get hundreds of my podcasts and three times as many of my films. And you won't be disappointed.
No siree, Bob.
And I'll also send you intimate photos when I'm drunk. So what are you waiting for? I'll see yous all over there. God bless each and every one of yous. Well, except for yous from those godless nations, which I won't mention. But your money is still good. Oh, and remember, with each 100th sign up, I'm going to buy one of my kids a pack of smokes and maybe even get them vaccinated. I thank you. The following podcast is a Deadbug podcast and is not suitable for children and contains language that may offend. So if you're ready to proceed, won't you sit back? Shut that pleasure-giving mouth of yours. Smoke 'em if you got 'em. And hit play. Austin, Texas. Summer 1965. The heat in Texas that year had a personality of its own. Not the kind of heat, mind you, that tourists talk about now, with the postcards and rooftop margaritas and women with their Daisy Duke shorts riding high with men's tongues swelling up, wanting to get to that sweet nectar inside. You know the score. Where there's live music spilling out into the streets, there's yelling and yelping from hillbilly cowboys gone rogue out in the streets. But no, this wasn't that kind of Texas. This was a heavier Texas. A Texas slower than a Down syndrome kid doing mathematics. A Texas where the air itself felt stained yellow by cigarette smoke and body odor, gasoline fumes. At night, Austin hummed. Neon signs buzzed over motor courts. Ice machines rattled behind roadside motels. Pickup trucks rolled down dark farm roads with country music blasting out through cracked windows. Trans was just a word to describe the transcontinental highway. And there were still real men who drank whiskey beneath low-moving ceiling fans, while women in pressed cotton dresses tried not to sweat through their makeup and still looking presentable. And hanging over all of it was that strange mid-1960s American feeling that it was a country caught between innocence and rot. The war in Vietnam was growing darker by the month. Young men were disappearing overseas, some of them to never come back. A new television series called The Addams Family had everyone laughing, sitting around the TV set. That's when they could get away from the news covering the civil rights protests that seemed to be interrupting things every hour upon the hour. The Dodgers won the World Series. Lyndon B. Johnson was president. And the Chevrolet Impala was America's top-selling car. But most importantly at all of this was that families still sat together for dinner. I know, bizarre as that concept may seem, pretending everything was normal, while something underneath had already begun to crack. And in Austin, Texas, there were two young women who vanished into that crack by the name of Susan Rigsby and Shirley Stark. Pretty, intelligent, educated. The kind of girls people described as good girls. The kind of girls the parents trusted. Church-going, sorority girls. Future teachers, mothers, wives. And by the end of July 1965, both of them would be dead. Their bodies would be found discarded in an empty field under the brutal Texas sun. What followed was one of the most unsettling murder cases in Texas history, because the killer was not some drifter or escaped convict lurking in the shadows. The killer sat beside them, talked with them, smiled at them. And according to police, he confessed. But even decades later, the case still leaves behind a strange taste, because nothing about it feels clean. Nothing about it feels finished. This is the story of the 1965 Texas co-ed murders. And now, before I give it all away like some half-assed storyteller out of a crackerjack box, let's go back in time to Austin. Back before the city became polished and modern. Back when lonely roads cut through open fields and the night felt endless. Back to the summer where two girls disappeared and evil lurked in broad daylight. Susan Rigsby and Shirley Stark were both 21 years old, both from Texas, both students connected to the University of Texas, and both had the kind of future that looked already mapped out for them. Teaching degrees, marriage maybe, children, small suburban homes with tidy lawns and station wagons parked out front. The American dream, as it was sold back in 1965. You know the score. Susan was a pretty, leggy, young thing. Elegant, thoughtful, the type of girl who'd make your ice cream melt. Friends described her as warm and intelligent. Well, Shirley, she was ambitious, pretty, and well-liked. The two young women were close friends and sorority sisters at Chi Omega. They had come to Austin in July of 1965 for entirely ordinary reasons. And that's always the terrifying part of stories like this, that no one ever realizes during these mundane moments that their death clocks were now ticking. On July 18th, they drove from Dallas to Austin in Shirley's yellow Corvair Monza. Now picture that for a moment. A bright Texas afternoon, long highways stretching south, radio playing softly, wind coming through the windows, two college girls laughing about boys and classes and apartments and summer plans. Summer plans that will never happen. The world still felt safe to them. Austin in 1965 was far smaller than it is now. The skyline barely existed. Beyond the university and downtown, much of the city opened into rough fields and undeveloped land. There were stretches where you could drive at night and see almost nothing beyond the telephone poles passing in the darkness. Susan planned to move into an apartment for summer classes. Shirley was visiting friends and handling university business before returning home. Simple plans, simple girls, nothing dramatic. When they arrived in Austin, there was a delay getting access to the apartment, so they stopped for lunch at a Holiday House restaurant, where they unexpectedly met Susan's friend Martha Blount and her parents. It was a nice surprise. It was one of those ordinary accidental meetings people remember forever afterwards, because it becomes the final memory before pain, before darkness, before catastrophe. The girls all laughed, ate lunch, and talked casually. Nobody noticed danger. Nobody sensed danger sitting nearby. After lunch, Susan and Shirley said they planned to visit a friend, a University of Texas student named James Cross. And this is where the story begins turning dark. James Cross Jr. was 23 years old. By every outward appearance, he did not look like a killer. He came from a respectable Fort Worth family. He was handsome, educated, intelligent. The son of a department store executive. He came from money. There were the haves and there were have-nots in America at the time, and I guess still now. But he was definitely one of the haves. He looked clean-cut, polished, well-mannered. The kind of young man parents would happily invite inside for dinner. Which, if we're being honest, is often exactly what makes people truly dangerous. The girls left lunch in the yellow Corvair. Friends saw them wave as they sped away, weaving through the Austin traffic. Disappearing like spiders, washed down the kitchen sink. And that was the last confirmed sighting of Susan Rigsby and Shirley Stark. Then, nothing. The girls vanished. And days passed. Then more days. When the keys to the new apartment were failed to be picked up, well, family members became worried. Friends became worried. And the police became involved. But remember, this was 1965. Investigations moved differently then. There were no cell phones, no surveillance cameras, no digital trail, no GPS tracking. If somebody disappeared, well, they could vanish almost completely. And Austin itself still carried that strange half-rural atmosphere. A person could disappear into open land and not be found for days, sometimes longer. As police searched, rumors spread through the university community. Had the girls run away? Met two strangers that kind of looked like Elvis and headed south to Mexico. It had happened in the past with others. Why not them? Had they been abducted, attacked by strangers? The city grew uneasy. Parents whispered warnings to daughters. This is why we give you curfews. Young women, stop walking alone at night. And no one was sure if it was true, but the skirts at the time, they seemed to get a little bit longer again. Reverting back to 1950s. And somewhere in Austin, the truth sat hidden beneath the July sun. It was 12 days after the girls had vanished that surveyors working near North Lamar Boulevard and Rundberg Lane discovered something horrifying in an overgrown field. Two young female bodies, a meal to the maggots, almost stripped of all their flesh. And the Texas heat itself had done terrible damage. The skin that was left looked almost like bacon, overcooked. And the girls were partially unclothed. Their bodies discarded carelessly among the weeds and the sunflowers, with both of their legs spread wide. As their final moments, a photograph of sorts of what their final moments must have looked like. Their bodies discarded amongst the weeds and the wild sunflowers. And suddenly Austin realized something terrifying. This wasn't a disappearance. This was a murder. The scene itself sounded almost cinematic in the worst possible way. Blazing sunlight overhead, dry grass bending in the hot wind like a blow dryer. insects buzzing, and two beautiful young women abandoned like trash in an empty field at the edge of the city. One cop described the crime scene as horrific, as the bodies had almost been burnt charcoal black from exposure to the summer Texas sun. Both girls were shot in the forehead, so they definitely saw it coming as they begged for their lives. Both had been raped, violated in every hole God had given them. It's unclear why one of them didn't run while he was raping the other. Possibly loyalty, fear. Who can say? Except for one of the girls. And they ain't squawking. The Texas Piggies believed that the girls could have been murdered somewhere else and then dumped there in the field. Transported from where? Who can say? The contrast to the murders disturbed the Texas townfolk deeply, because Susan and Shirley represented safety, respectability, middle-class American innocence. And now they had become symbols of something much darker. Something changing in America. Police immediately launched a massive investigation. Autopsies revealed that the girls had been murdered shortly after disappearing. And as aforementioned, they had been brutally raped. Untortured. Unbeaten. I guess as much as you could tell when the bodies were burnt like bacon. The brutality of the crime shocked even the most seasoned of investigators. Austin newspapers exploded with coverage. The city became consumed by fear. And almost immediately, suspicion turned towards 23-year-old James Cross. As the Blount family had mentioned, the two girls said they were meeting up with them. And besides the Blount family, he was the last known person connected to the victims. When police questioned him, at first Cross denied any involvement. But investigators noted inconsistencies. His timeline shifted. Not once, not twice, but it seemed constantly. His behavior became erratic. And then, according to police reports, Cross confessed. The confession stunned Texas. Clean cut, middle class kid. His family had money. It didn't seem your typical murder. It was safe to say that he wouldn't need to be ripping panties off girls, and they'd be usually dropping them for him. So why was this one different? Cross said he was friendly with the girls, and he met up with them for coffee. The investigators believed that Susan Rigsby and Shirley Stark went willingly to James Cross's apartment because they knew him socially through the university world. And this is important. There was no forced abduction at the beginning. No mass stranger. That makes what happened afterwards feel even more bizarre. Cross said once he'd got the two pretty girls back to his apartment, his bachelor pad, something snapped. And in his own words, he just went mental. And those exact words were, "I became mentally detached from reality." But prosecutors believed the crime showed planning and awareness afterwards. And honestly, some of the details make him sound cold as ice. The confession reportedly described Susan being attacked while Shirley was in the bathroom showering. Think about that psychologically for a second. A hot blonde who's in your bathroom showering. He must have been harder than a cat scratching post. That mental image is Shirley in the shower. The water running down her long, tan legs. And Susan in a miniskirt, only sitting inches away. He must have imagined putting that tip in until he could imagine no more. And he reverted to what all of us hide and subside deep down. A fucking animal. Shirley in the shower, singing her latest top 10 favorite, while her friend is being violated in every hole that God gave her, and a few she didn't even know she had. Then Shirley walks out, towel wrapped around her. And according to the prosecution narrative, Cross attacks her too. A menage a trois, leading to the abyss. And here's where it becomes even more sinister. If this tale could become more sinister. Some reports imply the murders may not have been instantaneous. There are suggestions of prolonged assault and panic inside the apartment before the killings were completed. The state believed sexual violence was the central to the motive. Lust. The basest coin there is. And then comes the detail that absolutely destroys the temporary madness image. After the killing, he allegedly hid the bodies in a closet overnight. Not immediately dumped, not panicked and fleeing, hidden. Hidden inside his apartment, where he then went and slept like a baby. A double raping, murdering and killing baby. That's a detail that horrified people during the trial, because prosecutors used it to argue this wasn't blind insanity. This was containment, concealment, decision making. And then somehow it gets worse. During the trial, a teenager comes forward and said that she'd met up with Cross socially that evening. And she said that he seemed in good spirits, even though he just killed two young women and raped them. And she admitted, embarrassingly, that he even finger-fucked her in the back of his car. Well, she went down on him, undoubtedly tasting the two girls he just murdered. The sort of image and thing that a jury member will remember forever. Because it suggests compartmentalization so severe, it feels almost inhuman. Now let's talk about his actual demeanor and his defense to these heinous crimes. Cross's attorney pushed hard for insanity. Not sadness, not remorse. But the kid ruined that job. Insanity, the number one defense of killers even to this day. The courtroom battle became, was James Cross evil or mentally broken beyond control? Psychiatrist testified, defense witness described him as emotionally unstable, deeply disturbed, detached from reality. Some reports from the era describe him as vacant and disconnected during the proceedings. And yet, Cross was still able to get two young, pretty co-eds to come back to his place and shower. Does money breed complacency? It's hard to imagine what these two girls were thinking. Are they just young, wild, and free? Did they trust him? Was there a sexual attraction? But prosecutors hammered one specific point. If Cross was so insane and he didn't understand his actions, why'd he hide the bodies? Why dump them miles away? Why attempt to avoid discovery? That contradiction sat at the center of the trial. And remember, 1965 juries were very suspicious of insanity pleas, especially in Texas. I mean, if you go to Texas and you commit a murder, well, you're guaranteed to go to the chair. So the defense had to paint him almost psychologically shattered beyond ordinary comprehension. Another fascinating detail, he was reportedly obsessed with religion and morality in strange ways after the murders. Some accounts suggest he drifted into bizarre guilt and emotional collapse afterwards, leading to his swift confession. But the confession itself is bizarre. He didn't get cornered dramatically by detectives. According to reports, Cross, after initial interview and denial of the crime, telephoned the police a couple of days later saying he wanted to confess. That changes the energy of the entire story. I mean, just picture it. Austin police have this major story about two girls missing and then murdered. And then suddenly the killer calls them. I mean, that's the shit movies are made out of. That's psychologically loaded. Why confess? Guilt, fear, mental collapse, desire for attention, or religious torment? When Cross pleaded insanity, the trial took on a completely different tone because psychiatrists became involved and the public became divided. Was he genuinely insane or simply manipulative? Was the confession real or coerced? By all accounts, the courtroom atmosphere reportedly became tense and theatrical. Newspapers described Cross appearing calm one moment and emotionally detached the next. And remember the cultural backdrop here. This is the mid-1960s. America had become fascinated by psychology and disturbed minds. The public was beginning to hear new language around mental illness, criminal pathology, and violent impulses. People wanted monsters to look monstrous, but James Cross, he didn't. He was a good-looking kid, and that unnerved everyone. He looked ordinary. And that's the detail that lingers in cases like this. Not the sexual violence. The normality. The fact that evil can wear a pressed shirt, drive a sports car, and smile politely, and pick up the tab at a fancy restaurant. During trial proceedings, horrific details emerged about the murders themselves. The prosecution painted Cross as a sexually violent and deeply disturbed young man. The defense insisted he was mentally broken, beyond comprehension. Ultimately, Cross was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And for many God-fearing folk in Texas, that verdict felt unjust and unbearable. The families of Susan and Shirley had lost everything. Two girls with futures erased in a patch of Texas weeds. And although the death penalty had been halted in Texas that year because of growing concerns and it just won't right if you believed in God, well, it seemed now that Cross would be avoiding traditional prison altogether and get a bed in a nice, comfy state mental institution. But the story still didn't end there. Years passed, America changed. The 1960s became the 1970s, and Vietnam War ended, and then the 1980s. Austin transformed. High rises appeared. The music culture exploded. The sleepy Texas city evolved into something modern and crowded. But the murders, well, they never fully disappeared, because every so often, James Cross resurfaced in the headlines again. Questions arose about his mental condition, about possible release, about whether he still posed a danger to society and pretty young girls. And every time his name appeared, it reopened those old wounds. Imagine being a parent of one of those girls and seeing the killer's name decades later in newspapers. Imagine the heartbreak, the fury, the helplessness, the exhaustion of grief that never fully leaves a parent of a murdered child. By the late 1980s, reports emerged that Cross had been released on bail during legal proceedings connected to his confinement. He just quietly walked away into the sunset. That news outraged many Texans because in the minds of the public, Susan and Shirley never got to leave. They never got another summer, never got older, never got to become teachers. Time stopped for them forever on that July day in 1965. And maybe that's part of the reason that this case still feels haunting to this very day. Not because it was the bloodiest crime in Texas history. Not because it remains unsolved. But because it shattered a very specific illusion. The illusion that good families, educated girls, bright futures, and respectable surroundings could somehow protect people from the evil that lurks in the shadows. The 1960s destroyed that illusion of normality, for want of a better word, again and again. The Texas co-ed murders, as it became known as, were part of that larger unraveling. Before Ted Bundy, before the Zodiac Killer, before America became fully aware of how charming predators could be, this case arrived at the edge of a cultural shift. And Austin itself almost feels like a character in the story, because old Austin was isolated in strange ways. People today imagine bustling tech campuses and crowded nightlife and music festivals. But in 1965, darkness still dominated huge sections of the city, with open land, lonely roads, fields stretching beneath giant Texas skies, with the heat and the sun blazing down. There's something especially terrifying about crimes committed in wide open places where there's no walls, no alleyways, no witnesses, just emptiness. As though that land itself swallows the screams. And even now, if you drive certain roads outside Austin late at night, you can still feel echoes of that older Texas. The neon signs may be newer, the highways wider. But once you leave the city glow behind, darkness returns quickly.
And it swallows the flat, black countryside.
Telephone poles disappearing into nowhere. And it becomes easy to imagine a bright yellow Corvette driving in the summer of July 1965, with two pretty girls inside, short skirts, believing they still had their whole lives ahead of them. How wrong they were. In cases like this, they leave scars, not because of the violence alone. And sure, there were plenty of that, but because of the interruption, the sudden tearing away of ordinary life. Susan and Shirley should have become old women. They should have enjoyed their life. They should have complained about grandchildren and taxes and aching knees. They should have forgotten the details of college summers because they were too busy, decades beyond them, and something maybe they would share at a reunion now and then. Instead, they remain permanently 21. Forever frozen in newspaper photographs. Hair perfectly styled. Bright smiles. Eyes that still look to trust in. That's what makes older murder cases so unsettling. The victims never age. But the world around them, well, it keeps moving. And eventually memory itself becomes fragile. People forget names, forget details. The city's built over old fields. Restaurants close, witnesses die. The landscape changes until it almost feels like the crime never happened at all. And somewhere in Austin tonight, people are driving roads connected to this story without even knowing it. And that's a strange thing about true crime. The world seems to keep building over horror. Coffee shops appear where terror once lived. Apartment complexes rise over old emptiness. Life moves on whether anyone is emotionally ready or not. But every so often a story claws its way back up through history. And the 1965 Texas co-ed murders remains one of those stories, not simply because of all the brutality, but because the atmosphere surrounding it, the feeling of innocence collapsing, the feeling of America changing shape in real time. The feeling that something dark had entered the modern age wearing a friendly face. And maybe that's why the case still lingers in the imagination decades later. Because deep down, it taps into one of society's darkest fears. Not monsters in shadows, but monsters sitting beside us in the daylight, talking softly, smiling politely, waiting. Susan Rigsby and Shirley Stark came to Austin expecting an ordinary summer week. Instead, they became part of Texas history. And in the unbearable heat of that July 1965, Austin lost something too. Not just two young women, but another piece of innocence. And maybe, just maybe, once innocence disappears, it never really comes back. James Claude Cross Jr. died in 2001 at the age of 58 years old. There is no public record of his cause of death. I guess it don't matter now. And this has been the facts, or at least how they are known, recounted by Dead Buck, your concierge to the abyss. And I'm going to close this one out with a song dedication for all of yous who have lost someone and dream of them coming back. But after a few drinks on a Friday night, you know they're never coming back.
And I keep if you're stuck at the corner stop. If you miss me just a little, turn around, make it simple. Your keys, cold little shine.